Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Welcome, Jim and Austin. It just happens today that we're recording this that it's Veterans Day, and I just would like to give a heartfelt thanks for all the vets out there and all those that are on active duty. Jim, you served in the artillery, right?
In the Army, yep.
In the Army.
In Korea.
You had to do a stint in Korea. Austin,
10 years after my uncle was there, you know, so it's a sort of a family tradition to go to Korea.
Right. And Austin, you served for a long time in the reserves, and you were on active duty for a while, correct?
Oh, yeah, I was in active duty several times back in the 70s, and then got called up for a Desert Storm, served in Washington, of course, various other short-term deployments, and then the last one was, of course, going back on active duty for Iraq.
Right, and you retired as, I can't remember, was it as a lieutenant colonel or a full bird?
No, full colonel.
Full colonel. So, officially, we should call you Colonel Bay every time we talk, right?
Yeah.
But we're friends, and so we call you Austin. My father, I didn't serve, but my father served in the Air Force and was stationed in Japan during the Cold War and tracked the Russian air armies. He was in Air Force Intelligence. And then in fact, I found out the other day that he was in the top 0.1% of the Air Force that was selected for the duty that he did while he was in. And then my brother is in the reserves and was on active duty, served in Iraq, and has been in Kosovo, and now is going back to Iraq again. He's an Army doc. He's a psychiatrist and deals with all the issues that modern warfare causes, and does that also in his day-to-day life. He works for the Veterans Administration. But I'm just, and then I have, and we all have numerous other relatives that have served, both going back decades and like that. And I think it's just important that we remember those and let everybody know that we're thankful for our vets and also those on active duty. But we're going to move on now to India and what's been happening over there just this past week and why the relationship between the United States and India is so important. Austin, you wrote an article recently about 4 weeks ago talking about the India trip and why it was important. You know, we've got all the political machinations that have been going on about how big Obama's entourage was and the this number of warships out in the Indian Ocean and like that. All that aside, though, the trip was an important trip, correct?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's one of many diplomatic initiatives. It's not a culmination, but it's part of a process that we can look back at. And I see the roots of it really as deep as the diplomatic roots of this. 25 years ago, and certainly, and I in the column that you're referring to that I wrote, Dan, I said this is truly a big news. It's news that's is already shaping 21st century history. One can make the argument, and I allude to it very briefly in that essay, and it's only 700 words long. You can only do so much with 700 words, but as with almost all the stuff that I try to do as a journalist, and certainly we do on Strategy Page, we want to pay attention to historical depth when we always pay attention to the history. And the United States and India have had rough patches diplomatically. The U.S. Was quote-unquote tilting towards Pakistan during the Cold War, and Pakistan and India after the separation after World War II were, of course, sworn enemies. But there were a number of things we had in common. One is that the lingua franca of India is English, sometimes spelled with an I, I-N-G-L-I-S-H, as a kind of a witticism, because they have their own English dialects. And they India also has the structure of a English-British parliamentary state, with, and it was a colony of Great Britain, just like the United States was. That said, India sought its got its weapons for the most part, bought them from Russia, Soviet Union. India experimented with various types of socialism after World War II, and in the process beggared itself. And then we come to really the end of the Cold War. We've seen what communist socialism did to Eastern Europe, did to Russia as well. And I'm being very, this is a big overview here, but the Indians say we're going to have to get our economic house in order. They also see the changes that are going on in China, those spurred in the really the late 70s, but carried through by Deng Xiaoping. And they, India and becomes a more entrepreneurial capitalist economy. The United States and India, again, it's easy to see in retrospect why India was a logical place for the phone centers for fixing computers or the like, because you have technically educated individuals that can speak English, and with modern communication systems, it really doesn't matter whether you're in Provo, Utah, Dan, or Phoenix, Arizona, or Bangalore, India. You're going to need to make the connection between the educated and able, and those who need the advice. And so what you see accelerating after the end of the Cold War is recognition, I think, first on the part of the United States, and there were plenty of Indians that recognized it, but, you know, with other animosities and the way the propaganda line went during the Cold War, that the United States was the imperialist. We weren't, but, you know, the anti-imperialists and anti-colonialists, the Russians exploited that agitation propaganda line, and you see some of that reflected in the politics of New Delhi and in politics of India. But you see, countering that, a number of developing common interests, economic interests, and then the rise of common defense interests. And does that say China? Yeah, it does say China, especially to the Indians. You remember, they've still got that frozen and Sino-Indian War of 1962 with the border issues along their Himalayan front. And they're the two Asian giants. And China knows that its real competitor in Asia is India. And India knows that its competitor is China. The Indians, on their part, we've written about this on Strategy Page. I think we've even got some things on the page. They go back 10 years commenting on defense initiatives with Indians taking them with the Singaporeans and with the Australians. And I picked up a couple of former British colonies there, but there's an interoperability because of language, and they have several the common interests, including the Singaporeans with the Indians. This is the fear of militant Islamism. And India's borne savage attacks over several decades, but over the last two decades. Look at the number of times Mumbai has been attacked. The Indian Parliament was hit by militant Islamist terrorists in December of 2001. That's one of the things that President Obama mentioned when he spoke in New Delhi, that common tie. So, again, this is diplomacy is incremental in many respects. It's slow, then it takes a while for the commonality of interest, sufficient number of the politicians to recognize the commonality of interest. But Obama was in his administration is pursuing initiatives that you can see going back, as I said, you know, two and a half decades. And I myself believe that you have really a functional alliance already between the United States and India. The Indians rile at the term alliance. They don't like that. They still want to take their, quote unquote, some of them take their third way, and the Indian left doesn't like the United States and the like. So, American diplomats don't want to use that word. And they flat out, as I pointed out in my article, they avoid it because of the emotional and political reactions among some segments of Indian population. All right? So it's not formalized. It's not formalized, but it is in the process of materializing. And don't think, and in that column I wrote, I took some things from the perspective of a Chinese admiral sitting in Beijing. China's long-distance sea routes to all the Chinese resources that they have been gathering in Southwest Asia, energy resources and mineral resources throughout Africa. It runs right past India, and there are a lot of reasons to call it the Indian Ocean, but the biggest one is that India dominates it.
Right. Now, Jim, one of the interesting things that President Obama threw out on the table was introducing the Indians onto the Security Council in the UN. I would not imagine that the Russians and the Chinese would be very open to that.
Well, few of the current members of the Security Council want, you know, their exclusive little club to be expanded. But the fact of the matter is, especially in the last three decades, the population, the economic landscape has changed quite a bit. China, which is already there, has the second highest GDP on the planet. India now has the second largest population. It's the world's largest democracy. It's a democracy with a population larger than Europe's. You know, if any country, and there are many, you know, trying to get on the Security Council, like Brazil and a few others, Indonesia, India certainly deserves it. But, you know, the drug bridges are raised. because India makes its case, or people make the case for India, by pointing out that France and Britain are no longer the, you know, superpowers they used to be. So why do they deserve to be there? This particularly miffs India, which was, you know, occupied, colonized by Britain for several centuries, that, you know, they now have a dynamically growing GDP, a large population, and they have for over half a century been a functioning democracy. So why shouldn't they get a place at the table? That's something that's really a sideshow. I mean, it probably would be interesting and perhaps nice for us to have India on the Security Council. But as long as Russia and China are there, they are always going to be at war with the West. They are always going to be a problem, as we're seeing now, with how they support Iran and North Korea. Well, less North Korea, not as much anymore. But Iran depends a lot on Security Council support from Russia and China. India, given its long self-appointed position as head of the third world, you know, the former colonial state, they would probably make mischief as well, you know, just to score points. I mean, as Austin pointed out, you know, the left in India is still stuck in the Cold War. They are really a throwback. I mean, they have Maoist rebels. They have 10,000-15,000 Maoist rebels, communist rebels in eastern India, causing a lot of trouble. Not nearly as much as the Islamic, you know, terrorists have, but, you know, there are a lot of them, and they are a nuisance. And that is part of the, you know, the strong left that is in India. And the left is somewhat disconnected from reality, especially in economic matters. So you can imagine how much fun they would be on the Security Council. But it's probably not going to happen.
Right. I mean, even those who were for it said that the earliest anything like that can happen is, I think, 2013 or 2014.
Yeah.
Now, one of the interesting things.
Dan, can I make a comment about that?
Go ahead.
I'm for it. I think the UN has fossilized. It's fossilized in 1945 in the way that it's structured, and I think that's part of the reason that you don't see it functioning as a kind of a effective institution or more effective institution that it, well, it's, I can catch myself here on this. It's one of the reasons it's so ineffective, and a change like that is just accepting the reality of what India has achieved and what India is. You know, the other names that pop up, I don't want to take an alley on our discussion, and we're focused on India, but as Jim pointed this out, Japan, Germany gets mentioned occasionally when you hear the mentions of, well, I've got to have an African state on there, South Africa, well, maybe Nigeria, whatever. But the thing is that India's success already, and it's real global eminence, says that if you're going to have a real functioning, permanent, quote-unquote, permanent member of the Security Council, India needs to be there. And it's not. And I'm glad that we've supported it. This is something that that the U.S. has talked about. We're not against it. And President Obama says, you know, that's official U.S. policy now. But I recall discussions, Dan, 15, 16, 17 years ago, about the diplomatic and military diplomatic, were about adding India as a permanent member of the Security Council. I regard it as in some ways inevitable. Well, it's not inevitable if China and Russia veto it. France might veto it. I actually think Great Britain might support it with the United States, but it's, I think this is also a comment on the fossilization of the UN.
So. Right. Now, Jim, from the United States-India perspective, is India a huge potential buyer of arms and support and helping out our defense industrial complex from an economic standpoint as buyers in the future? I know you wrote about them buying jet engines from us just the other day.
Well, they also bought 10 C-17 transports. That's a deal that's been in the works for a while, and Obama officially signed off on that. And the Indians followed up by saying, well, now we've committed to 10, how about another 6? So they are already a major purchaser of Western arms. And this is difficult for India because, again, the leftists in the government. I mean, you got to remember, India is population-wise more than twice the size of Europe, and they have more ethnic groups. There are 19 major languages, hundreds of dialects and lesser languages. There are 350 million English speakers. There's more people in India speaking English than in the United States. They are a very complex country politically. People who study India closely are amazed at how they've managed to keep their democracy going. They've often kept it going, the same way they make sausage. You'd rather not, look at the details too closely. There's a lot of corruption, not as much. I mean, they are not at the top of the list of the most corrupt countries, but they are up there, and at least they are fighting it effectively, somewhat effectively. But they are a difficult ally to have, as anyone who has been an ally of India can attest. But the ball is already rolling as far as arms sales goes. They are fed up with Russia. Russia was, well, during the Cold War, Russia was good enough. But now they are confronting China, and Russia is no longer good enough because the Chinese have already stolen all the Russian-Chinese military technology. So just buying from Russia gives them parity with China, which isn't really sufficient as far as the Indians are concerned. So they're looking to the United States. They have there's a big competition going on now to buy 127, first-line, jet fighters. And Americans are competing for that. And the Indians are glad to have the Americans in there. Of course, so are the Russians and the Europeans and what have you. But their big enemy now is China, and they need an ally they can depend on. And they don't feel that they can depend on the Russians, because the Russians technically should be a great ally against China, because Russia is also worried about China. Most of the Far East, Far Eastern areas of Russia are claimed by China. And the Russians are basically dancing as fast as they can diplomatically to avoid that from escalating. But they also have to look at what's happening with India and China, where China is making very open and strong demands on disputed territories on the Indian border, especially Arundhati Pradesh, if I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
It's northeastern, it's a northeastern province that used to be part of Tibet. But when Tibet was independent after the 1911 overthrow of the monarchy in China, the borders of India were being surveyed and, you know, redrawn, as it were. And Tibet, apparently for some defensive consideration from Britain, said, all right, India can have that. I mean, it's really a nothing area. You know, it's large, it's mountains, it's the border, the northern border is in the high Himalayas, you know, and it's mostly jungle and hills. And I think even today there's only about 1 million people up there. So it's not something that is particularly valuable, although now the Chinese and the Indians both think there are mineral and other deposits in there that might be, you know, a lot more valuable than anybody could get at, almost a century ago. But the Chinese are being very blatant about their claims now, and that's got to make the Russians nervous. And the Indians feel, well, if we got to choose a good ally, there's the United States. They're already, you know, at loggerheads with China. So, you know, hey, you know, we have something in common. Same thing with Israel. You know, the Indians are actually very much on the outs with the Muslim world, even though for thousands of years India was a major trader, you know, with Arabia and the Persian Gulf, you know, states, and still is to a certain extent. But Hinduism was declared anathema, you know, by Muhammad. You know, there was Judaism and Christianity, which were people of the book, you know, a common religious heritage, but the Indians were considered, you know, pure pagans, although in actuality there are Hindu roots in Islam, which they don't like to talk about. You know, it's like the crazy uncle that, you know, you just don't want to discuss. Be that as it may, India is the big bad. I mean, the great Satan, but, you know, India is something beyond that. So India has, you know, mutual interest with Israel, who is also on the big bad as far as the Islamic world is concerned. And they have China with the United States as an enemy in common, you know. So despite the political, internal political hostility towards the United States, most Indians see the United States as a good ally. And one must not underestimate, despite the leftist, you know, politics, which is mostly only, you know, suffered, shall we say, inside of India. It doesn't get into the foreign policy that much. Most of the upper class or the middle class in India is very pro-America, because a lot of them have kin, you know, cousins, whatever, who have gone to America or have been educated in America. And now you have all those call centers and that outsourcing, what have you. There are business relations with America. There's a lot of goodwill. So, you know, it's sort of a natural fit. And you shouldn't be too shocked or surprised by some of the things you read in the Indian press about the United States, because that's just the internal politics, which is still fighting, you know, the Cold War, or in some cases, you know, the British colonial period. They are a good fit with the United States, and I think that's the direction we're going.
Right.
Well, what Jim just said is totally true. There are elements in the media that are in the Cold War, and even further back, they're, you know, they're fighting the British Raj or whatever. And then check it out on the internet. It's totally right.
Right. Now they have
fun reading.
It is fun.
when you understand the historical dimension, it can be entertaining.
Especially because it's all in English too.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, and uniquely Indian English, which is, you know, fun as well. Normally you don't get English written in dialect, but in India you do, because they have their own unique dialect. But you can imagine how Australian newspapers or British newspapers would read if they printed it, you know, in one of the local dialects. Great fun.
Right. And I guess we should admit that we pick up some of our news from India because they do have so many outlets there.
Yes.
Look,
yeah, their
regular readers of several Indian online media outlets, and they're quite good. Some of their diplomatic reporting is just top rate. So.
Right, and we have
they gave a slightly different slant, and in many cases, especially when they're talking about South Asia, their correspondents are there. You know, they have better insights, and really, in some respects, you know, the Indian media is punching way above its weight. I mean, it's underappreciated. Because they are all over the place, they all speak English, and many of them are very good. That's why you've heard these rumblings from American newspapers at one point. I don't know if that's still going on, of outsourcing some of their journalism to India. That raised a huge stink among, you know, American journalists because they knew it could work. But you know, that's how far they have gone in terms of journalism. They don't get credit for that. I suppose they eventually will.
Right. And we have we know that we have Indian readers here on strategypage.com because we get nastygrams from them every once in a while, don't we, Jim?
Yes. Actually, we have a higher ranking among internet sites in India than we do in the United States.
Right.
So you could say we're more popular in India than we are in the United States.
That's true.
One can make of that what one will.
Now, the other thing that's happening is we're not only outsourcing to India, and there's some economic reliance there on us, but we have a number of Indian technical specialists coming into the United States on special visas and like that. I asked my brother about this because I've had a number of medical issues over the last several years, and I would swear that all but one of the specialists I've seen are Indian. And I asked my brother about it, and he said it's because our medical schools are limiting the number of graduates, and so in order to fill these slots, that they've had to open it up to Indians. But it's not only that, but we've been bringing in computer specialists and other specialists from India too. That seems to me like we're going to start building up our Indian population here in the United States.
That's been growing, you know, especially since the 1960s. In India, it's relatively easy to get a good education. They have some very good schools, colleges, but it's much more difficult to get a good job with that education. And at first, a lot of them went to Britain, but the United States quickly became the magnet, you know, after World War II and independence. You know, any high-ranking graduate in an Indian university quickly discovered that, the gold was in America. And that's where many of them are. But not so much anymore. A lot of them are staying in India because you have a huge middle class. There are several hundred million people by local standards are middle class. By middle class, I mean they can hire a maid, you know, so my American standards are a little above that. But they, a lot of them are going back, and which is something we should be acutely aware of because over half of the major startups in Silicon Valley have Indians as principals.
Right.
They play a huge role in the Silicon Revolution, shall we say. And it's often easy to overlook because you look at the group pictures, they just look like maybe they're Italian, you know, whatever, depending on what part of India they come from.
Yeah.
And if you look at the names, it ain't Italy, babe.
Right. You see the name Gupta appearing quite often.
A lot.
There was a large computer firm back in the 80s and 90s that was headed up by a man named Gupta. Yeah, so we've got that going on. The interesting thing was I picked up an article the other day that said that India was looking to hire Americans.
Yeah, Americans have one of the big problems with the technical exchange was the cultural differences. Every country is different in that respect, and America has a particularly, you know, American skill set required to, you know, function. Most of the entrepreneurs coming from India, they came here to go to college. They came at an age when they could absorb the new culture. and they became American, or as I call them, bicultural. They could still go back to India and be Indians, but they walk into an American business and they talk American, as it were. And as they have more of this outsourcing business, they have more, one of the weaknesses they have discovered was not having people on site in the Indian side who understood exactly what those Americans were talking about. You know, you get a bunch of American engineers sitting down saying, well, this is what we need. And if they don't have an Indian among the American group, there will often be a cultural confusion. And so what they are looking for in many cases is Americans to go to India, quickly absorb, you know, what's going on in India. In fact, I think there's a new TV show called Outsourcing or something like that, which makes fun of that. I mean, a lot of it's, you know, typical, you know, cultural confusion, cultural, you know, shock and what have you. But if you're doing business, it's a matter of dollar and cents. You can lose a contract if you don't grasp them. And a lot of the disasters I've heard of, like downtown on Wall Street, where there's been some outsourcing, I hear it from IT guys. 90% of the time, the problems are, you know, cultural misunderstanding. You said this, and I thought you meant that.
Right.
And so the Indians are looking to hire Americans to basically take care of, you know, existing business, but also to help them get new business. To basically sit there and say, all right, look at this situation over in the router, particular, you know, router business and what have you, and what do you see going on there? So part of it is not just technical, but business intelligence. They need people who can speak American as, in terms of, you know, the cultural aspects, not just the language.
Right, and that's because they had actually started losing contracts from the United States. Had started, some of the firms had started pulling back from India.
Because of that.
Right. As you know, I used to own an IT firm, and my people started working with India, and they told me about all the horror stories, of course. They never told me about the successes. That wouldn't be any good.
Exactly. You need bad news. But for Indian firms, every lost contract is a big deal. You know, a lot of times these are big bucks, and quite often they lost it to another Indian firm that was more tuned in with those cultural differences. So it's become a competitive matter with Indian companies. But they also find on a global scale, the American standards, you know, in terms of, you know, software design or governance, corporate governance, or how you basically deal with IT issues, is set by the Americans. And so they find, well, if they're the world standard, we better get up there if we're going to compete on a global basis.
Right.
Dan, I was just taking a look at the time. We've got a lot more to say about India, you know.
And I'm sure we'll talk about them again. They seem to come up about every 3 or 4 months, and on the site they seem to come up almost every other day.
Absolutely.
So it's going to.
You know, the thing is, in an upcoming strategy talk, let's get into some of the things that were raised too about the Indo-Pakistani relationship.
Right, which is going to be a big issue as the United States alliance grows because of our relationship with Pakistan and our need for our relationship with Pakistan with what's going on in Afghanistan and the other Middle East countries.
Yes, and in terms of India, why India now considers Pakistan a secondary issue.
Right.
Which is insulting as hell to the Pakistanis. India has bigger fish to fry.
Right.
All right, we'll
wrap it up, and we'll talk to you next time, gentlemen. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.